Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Matt Johnson.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. Final guest on this new run of The First Time is someone who's managed to maintain their resolutely left-field post-punk credentials while also finding themselves frequent visitors to the 80s pop charts, a cult band who also existed in the mainstream. And we say band, but really the band were and are the vehicle for one person's vision, a vision that's encompassed songs about the deeply personal and the deeply political. And even a long break from songwriting and fronting the group didn't dim his passion and the love his audience have for his work. I'm very happy to be welcoming to The First Time from the Matt Johnson. This is the day your life will surely change. This is the day when things fall into place. In this episode, we cover Matt's childhood, brought up at a London pub famous for its gigs by 60s bands, and his obsession with music and a single-minded determination to become musician. We talk about his teen years working in Soho in the late 70s as post-punk changed the landscape and the formative releases that would set the scene for the. We also, of course, cover their commercial and critical success in the 80s with the albums Soul Mining, from which you just heard the track This Is The Day, Infected and Mind Bomb, and some of the hugely ambitious projects and pressure that came to define that era for him. Now we also have Insolment, the first new the album in 25 years. But I started by asking Matt, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, I had quite an unusual upbringing in that I lived above one of East London's most famous music pubs in the 1960s, called the Two Puddings. So from a very early age, I was aware of music coming up through the floorboards. And also, my Uncle Kenny happened to be East London's top music promoter, and he promoted people like John Lee Hooker, The Kinks, The Who, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, Screaming Lord Sutch, and countless others. And some of them would appear in the Two Puddings, and some in other venues that he would then rent out. It was very strict in those days, the laws in terms of children being allowed into pubs. And also it was late, it would have been time for our bed, I suppose. But we were aware of the music coming up, we would listen to that. And during the day, we would play around on their equipment when they weren't around. And there was an old piano in the pub that I used to play around on. And also, there probably would have been an old Ready Fusion music system in there, if not a jukebox, I suppose, at that point. And music like the Beatles, Tamla Motown particularly. I remember a track by Donovan called Mellow Yellow. I loved that as a little boy. I remember that coming up through the floorboards.
I'm just mad about saffron. Saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow. I'm just mad about 14. 14's mad about me.
As far back as I can remember, you know, I was 1 year old when we moved into the Two Puddings, so from a very, very early age, I was surrounded by music.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not just like being surrounded by music, it's living inside a music environment, like every day, someone different coming through. They often say the formative experiences that you have, you know, before you're 7 years old shape everything, but that kind of idea of you've never just done music, you've built worlds of music, be that film or be that soundtrack. So you could almost say that that idea of living inside music was kind of set in motion from as soon as you could hear it, I guess.
Yeah, very, very much so. I suppose the other thing, I always loved film music, television music, and in that era we had all these incredible TV programmes such as The Avengers. What incredible stuff. It was when John Barry did a lot of stuff for television as well. So, and then in later years got aware of other composers like Nino Rota and Ennio Morricone, Bernard Herrmann. And so that was something that really drew me in as well, because my family always loved films. I had an uncle who was a film extra, and my grandparents, I think my first memory of seeing a film was my dad's mum, my nanny Ginny. Mary Poppins it was, took us to see it. So film and music was very, very important part of my formative years. And funnily enough, whenever the customers in the pub, you know, adults tend to ask little kids, what do you want to do when you grow up? And from the age of five, I said, I'm going to be a singer or an actor.
Really? You kind of had that straight away?
Absolutely knew, without any doubt. And so school for me was a minor inconvenience when it came along, because I knew what I wanted to do and I was determined to do it. And the pub, when it was closed, was like a magic kingdom to us, because we would run around and all the way from the cellar and the boiler rooms and the all the way up to attics and balconies. You know, children have incredible imaginations and you can create fantasy out of nothing, really. And so I realised also, once I started school and started making friends, most of my friends, their parents had more traditional 9-to-5 jobs. I realised our upbringing was quite unusual, and I was grateful for that, actually. Single that I bought, I think it was 1972, was actually Nut Rocker by Bee Bumble and the Stingers. It was originally released in 1962, but it was reissued in 1972. It was produced by legendary eccentric producer Kim Fowley. Instrumental, it takes elements of Tchaikovsky, and it's this crazy sort of 60s piano piece. I ended up being addicted to singles, and it was a very rich time in terms of glam rock. You know, you had obviously Slade, who my brother liked, T-Rex, who I loved, David Bowie, of course, who we all loved. Bands like The Sweet did some amazing recordings. Alice Cooper's early recordings, Mott the Hoople, All the Young Dudes, Hawkwind, Silver Machine. There were so many great records coming out at that time. And my brother and I got addicted, and we lived in a little town. At this point, by the early 70s, although our parents still owned the two puddings, we moved to Suffolk for a few years, and then we moved to a town called Ongar in Essex. But anyway, there wasn't a record shop there, but there was a toy shop which had a little department that sold records. And the toy shop was called Toy Fair, I think. And my brother and I, every Saturday, we would save up our pennies. And we'd go there and buy singles, and we were absolutely addicted. But we had also had an additional benefit, because the pub had a jukebox. This was another pub called the King's Head that we were living above at this point.
All right. Access to the jukebox. That's brilliant. That's what you want.
Yes. And once a month, the man would come, the jukebox man, we called him, would come to change the records. And they would only be thrown away. And we'd be hovering around, and he would give them to us. And so we would augment our growing singles collections with singles off the jukebox, which were obviously a bit scratched up at that point, but we didn't care. And so we built up quite a huge singles collection. In those days, obviously no internet, there was limited information. You'd have, you know, there'd be, was it Pop of the Picks? What was the Alan Freeman programme on a Sunday evening? Pick of the Pops, not Pop of the Pops. Ba, 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 ba. And then old Alan Freeman, who had a wonderful voice, would come on, and you'd sit by the radio with your tape recorder to record the songs, that singles that you didn't have. But there was a magic about it. And I'm sure for kids today, there's an equal magic, I suppose, finding stuff on Spotify or on YouTube or whatever. But it was a different world then, and one which, you know, I was only a little boy of 11 or something. And it seemed very, very magical to me. And every aspect of the records, the smell of them, the touch, the colours, and obviously the sound of them, was incredibly powerful for us as kids. And not only me and my brothers, it was all of our friends were addicted to singles as well.
So who did you want to be at that point when you mimed with a tennis racket or a rubbish guitar in front of the mirror?
Mark Bolan. We got the tennis rackets out, and we would dress up, even to the point where I think our mum had some platform shoes, and I would steal them when she was working in the pub downstairs. We would nick them, and we would change the light bulbs over to dark red or dark green light bulbs, and we had an old radiogram, And so we would have this stack of singles, and me, Andrew and Eugene, we would get the tennis rackets out, dress up, and one of us would be DJing, or we'd take it in turns, and we would just leap around the room pretending to be Mark Bolan or David Bowie. Fantastic. We had and so unselfconscious, and just the pure joy of getting inside the music and being moved to just leap around. It was really magical, actually.
So when did you first perform in some form on stage? When was the first time you were like, from tennis rackets to like actually singing or playing in front of an audience of some kind?
That was about 12 or 13. We performed at some people's birthday parties and also local village halls. You get paid about £5. I think at one village hall we played too long and they turned the electricity off to stop us. I started as a songwriter about 13.
That is early.
Very early. And that was pre-punk, actually. I mean, post-punk, everyone was doing it, but it was very unusual pre-punk for kids just to be doing it off their own back, which we did. And we did cover bands like, we did a couple of Deep Purple songs like Black Knight, Smoke on the Water, David Bowie, we do like Rebel Rebel, we do some Beatles songs, Free, All Right Now, plus our own songs, so we were learning. So that experience, doing something creative, the joy of making music with your friends, was something that really became embedded within me at a very early age, you know, and I didn't want to do anything else. How can anything be better than this?
This is it. I found it now.
Yeah, I was very, very, very lucky. And again, that relates to what I went through much younger in the Two Puddings, being drawn to music and then finding there's a way you can do this with your friends. And then obviously, after that, I was a terrible truant and I left school. I ran away from school at 15. I failed all my exams. I just had no interest in school, really. I learnt to read and write, thankfully, so I then educated myself after I'd left school, pretty much. But at the age of 15, I was lucky enough to get a job in a recording studio, music publisher, in Soho.
I mean, because normally a question that we ask musicians is, oh, when's the first time you ever went to studio? And you kind of worked in one. But to be in a studio at that point in time, at that location, I mean, I can't think of any more exciting and like creative kind of hotbed to be thrown into. What was that like?
It was absolutely brilliant, I've got to say. And how that came about was interesting because there was a book by a chap called Tony Hatch, who you've probably heard of. He was a famous songwriter, but he gained a bit of national notoriety as one of the sort of compares, almost like an early version of Simon Cowell, I suppose. There was a programme called New Faces, and there was him. He was one of the judges, along with Mickey Most and a couple of other people. And Tony Hatch was probably the most sort of hardcore, cynical. He was a bit hard-nosed towards the contestant. But interestingly, he wrote this book. I think it was called So You Want to Be in the Music Business. And I think it was my cousin Jack who gave me the 50p to buy the book. In it, he spoke about different famous producers and musicians and singers who had started out working in record companies and music studios, recording studios, at a very low level as T-boys and worked their way up through the industry. Because at this point, I thought, I knew I wanted to be in music, but how can I get my foot in the door? I didn't know how to make a living. A lot of my friends at school were going to work in factories and offices, and I thought it just wasn't for me. You know, I wanted a sense of freedom and creativity. So what I did, at the back of the book, it had an index with lots of record companies and recording studios and music publishers. So I just sat there, didn't tell anybody, didn't even tell my parents. I just started writing all these letters to try to get an interview. Luckily, I did get one interview. I got a lot of rejection letters, but I got one interview, which was from DeWolf. And they asked me up for an interview, and my dad took me up there. I was dressed in my nice little jacket and shirt and tie. And first interview, they gave me the job, which I was delighted about. So at the age of 15, I was hanging around Soho, which in those days was a very different place than it is today.
I think that's an underestimation. Yeah.
Yeah. The film industry was there in force, but it was the red light district. And a lot of brothels and unsavoury, seedy characters roaming around. And I did get accosted a couple of times. But that aside, there was also a great music scene. We were next door to the Marquee, so I was in there all the time and hanging out, making new friends, being exposed to new music. And a colleague of mine, a chap called Colin Lloyd Tucker, who I'm still friends with to this day, he introduced me to, at the age of 15, to the Velvet Underground and Marijuana. So I got him to play.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, magazine's corset, Jane is in her vest. And me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding a studs back at gym. You know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
And also, he taught me to make tape loops and tape phasing, so it was very creative for me. I learnt a hell of a lot. It was a rite of passage to me, really, from going from this school that I hated in Essex to suddenly being Soho at 15, in the heart of things, and going to all these gigs and meeting all these interesting people. So it was very, very formative. And it was around about that time, shortly after that, I was about the age of 17, that I started putting adverts in the music press. It would be, they used to have classified ads. I don't know if they still do. Well, there's not really a music press. It doesn't exist as it did in those days. But in the Melody Maker and the NME, they used to have loads of classified ads, and you would have people that wanted to get bands together. You put a little advert in there. And I put in things like, I'm into Velvet Underground and Sid Barrett and Throbbing Gristle and Residents. And the other thing I put in was enthusiasm more important than the ability, because I wasn't trained as a musician. I'm very much self-taught, but I was more into the ideas, and particularly the post-punk world. Not the punk world, but the post-punk world that came after punk, which was very experimental, and that was my spiritual home. So that's where I came from. And then there I put an advert in the NME, and I got more like-minded people, one of whom was this chap called Keith Laws, who became my first keyboard player. And Keith then introduced me to bands like Faust and Neu and Kraftwerk and Krautrock. And so all the people I would meet, whether it was Colin or Keith, would then introduce me to new music. So, yeah, so at 17, there was formed. And out of all those bands, I was younger than, you know, all the bands I was hanging out with, like Wire and This Heat, Cabaret Voltaire, Throbbing Gristle. I was quite a bit younger than those guys. I was like the kid on the block, really. But they were very welcoming and very encouraging, and it was a very exciting time for me.
Yeah, you've talked about Wire once or twice as being a kind of band whose ethos and your connection to them was quite influential. What Wire songs should we play at this juncture to illustrate that?
Anything from 154, that was the album of theirs that really influenced me. I've still got a white label copy of it that they gave me at the time it came out.
Oh, nice. That's a retirement job, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And we... We supported them. We did a couple of shows with them at the Notre Dame Hall, which is a beautiful venue in Leicester Square. And that was a really big deal for me, because what was interesting was that there was a little technique that I learned in terms of if you're nervous about something, like a particular event. What I found a very useful device, which I first put into practice on that day, is that you put two or three very big events on the same day so that the nervousness about one overrides the other. So I decided to have my driving test when I was 17 on the same day as these big gigs with Wire. And I passed my test with, because I was so relaxed for the driving test, because I was more worried about the shows with Wire. And I've passed my driving test, which was interesting.
Deciding it was soon. Music's most beloved artists.
In that moment, you have this sort of idea that something extraordinary is going on.
A rare and deeply insightful conversation about his complex relationship with music.
You capture yourself, but when you listen to it back, it kind of slips away.
With the bad seeds.
I could just hear the band so happy.
And with us.
Into my arms.
Marianne Hobbs.
Nick Cave and us. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio
6 Music.
Matt Everett's The First Time with Matt Johnson.
6
Music. Music.
So the first release that you were responsible for, that would be See Without Being Seen. It wasn't the but it kind of was. Was that the first thing that you actually were able to go, this is in the shops in some form?
Well,
the first release, kind of.
I consider it my first release, but it wasn't in the shop. So what See Without Being Seen was a record that I made. I bought this lovely old, well, not lovely old tape recorder. It's a lovely old tape recorder now, but at the time it was a brand new tape recorder. It was called an Akai 4000 DS Mark II. It was like the poor man's Revox. I couldn't afford a Revox.
Okay.
but this is what budding musicians, and this was before the Porter Studios were released, you know, the TAC 4 tracks. So I saved up, and I think it cost me £147, which was a lot of money for me back then. And I saved up for a long time. I got it. And I've never been so excited about a piece of equipment. I remember getting it out of its box. I was so thrilled. And that became my best friend for many years. So I would use that to write songs and record. And I built a little studio in the cellar of my parents' pub with rudimentary effects boxes and bits that I would beg, steal or borrow bits of equipment. And so I created this record. And I would take the recordings into DeWolf. And I would run them through their equalizers or compressors.
Oh, cool. So you get to use all the pro mastering stuff at the end of the process, but you still had an immediate DIY recording.
Exactly.
Cool.
So I had that little combination. But what I did, I approached a few record companies and they passed on it. I thought, you know what, I'm going to duplicate the cassettes myself. So I've got a load of cassettes. I created these little sleeves, photocopied them on the photocopier at DeWolf. Got a load of cassettes, C30 cassettes or whatever they were. It wasn't a long album. And then I would start trying to sell them at gigs or hand them out. And that's what I did. So although it wasn't in the shops, but I was out there at these underground gigs trying to sell them to people. And I sold a few of them. And it wasn't that many that I made up.
Caught in a dreamlike substance of my choice. Open is my head and receptive to it.
Thank you.
In recent years, we actually remastered that and reissued it on CD with some additional tracks from that era. And I've got to say, you know, I did it when I was 16, 17. It was actually quite good, quite experimental. It was quite good. So in my mind, although it wasn't released vinyl and CD, obviously, back in the day, it was on cassette. And I do consider that my first release, really, yeah.
Controversial Subject is technically the debut of the single.
Yes, it is.
On 4AD 1980.
Yep.
Did that mark kind of a psychological change in where you were going, giving it an official name where it becomes a project? Professional, some should even say.
Yeah, and we'd been doing gigs for a while, supporting some of those bands I mentioned earlier on, but I had a manager then, Tom Johnston, who I'm still friendly with. He was quite a well-known cartoonist for Fleet Street when I met him. He used to do political cartoons and stuff for Evening Standard, I believe, and then he went to other papers after that. But he sort of took us under his wing. He was about 10 years older, but he was a lovely man, Tom. In fact, he introduced me to Eric Satie, which I'd never heard before, the beautiful piano music of Eric Satie, and amongst other things. And Tom was friendly with the guys from Wire, and he introduced me to them, and he arranged for them to produce a couple of songs, which was Controversial Subject and Black and White. And we went to Blackwing Studios, which was in South London, and we recorded those. And then Ivo liked what he heard, because I think Ivo actually had a relationship with Bruce and Graham from Wire. They started to do some projects with him, and Ivo come down to see us at the 101 Club, liked what he heard. He said he'd like to put that single out. So that came out. John Peel liked it and played it quite a bit. And it did quite well in the indie charts. It was interesting because at that time, I was being approached by a lot of different labels, although I'd been turned down by a lot of labels, like Rough Trade a few times and various other ones. They were very encouraging. And at this point, then Cherry Red were interested, and I did a publishing deal with them. Some Bizarre, which was Steve-O's label, wanted to do something, as well as 4AD and some other labels. And so Ivo was quite relaxed. It wasn't like a major label situation where you signed a long-term deal. So I then did a single with Some Bizarre, which was called Cold Spell Ahead, which then later became Uncertain Smile. But at the same time as that, Ivo said to me, I sent him some other demos I was working on. He said, how about you do a solo album with 4AD? And then that became Burning Blue Soul, and Bruce and Graham from Wire, they produced a couple of tracks of that album. And so it was an odd situation because this kind of existed still, apart from, you know, with Keith on and off. And so I really should have used the name there, I suppose, for Burning Blue Soul, but it was still kind of limping on as a duo with Keith. Although, anyway, it was a bit confusing at that time. But so I put it out under my own name of Matt Johnson, which then in later years, I rebranded it as the so that it would be stacked with the other the labels, because it really is a the record.
Going back, you mentioned, and I was going to ask you about Eric Satie, because it's obviously another musician who you've referenced.
Well, I just remember Tom, I think he had a flat in Walthamstow. He had some plants in the room, and there was this light coming through. It was a sunny day, like evening sunlight, and there was this dappled light through the plants, and he had an old record playing. He said, look, have you heard Eric Satie? And I said, no. And he got this old vinyl and put it on. It was all crackly. And it was, I can't remember off the top of my head, which piece it actually was that he played, one of the more famous pieces, I suppose. And I was just absolutely blown away. It was so haunting and beautiful. I'd never heard anything like it. You know, fell in love with it immediately. Thank you.
So 1983, Soul Mining, which is kind of technically the first Thither album. I'll tell you, it's really interesting listening to that record, and I listened to it before this interview. It's aged incredibly well. There's records of that era, 83, 84, 85, some of which just the production hasn't aged well. And I don't know what you thought about why that record, because the synths used and the bass sounds are all kind of very of the moment. But there's something about it which means it still sounds quite contemporary, and a lot of records of that era have not enjoyed the same fate. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a large part of the credit has to go to my co-producer, Paul Hardiman, who was a brilliant engineer and an old-school engineer. Also, the fact it was an analogue recording. There was no digital at that time at all, so it's very analogue.
Right.
And we did use synthesizers, but also it was blended in with acoustic drums. There was cellos, marimbas, accordions, fiddles, as well as acoustic and electric guitars. So I think it's a combination of the instrumentation, the warmth of the analogue recording, which Paul's largely responsible. He's brilliant as an engineer. And I suppose subject matter as well. Things like This Is The Day, it's quite universal and eternal, really. A subject matter like that, and Uncertain Smile. Those songs, they age well because people still have those feelings. There's still the feelings of unrequited love, still the feelings of wanting to turn your life around and waking up in the morning and making decisions on who you want to be, where you want your life to go, and also those feelings of nostalgia that we all have. It's part of the human condition.
Peeling the skin back from my eyes, I felt surprised that the time on the clock was the time. I usually return to the place where I cleared my head and view. But just for today, I think I'll lie here and dream of you. I've got you under my skin where the rain can get in. But if the sweat pours out, just shout. I'll try to swim and call you out.
And it was one of those slow, like many of my albums, slow burning albums that, you know, I've had number twos, but I've never had number one. But so they've never been huge hits at the time, but they've sold consistently over time, and they don't seem to go out of fashion, which is something I could have only dreamed about. I'm very grateful for that, because it's been a very slow burn career, rather than I've had contemporaries that have had such explosive success at the start of their career that it's kind of ruined their lives, really, because it's sent them insane. Too much fame too soon can be a very dangerous thing, and the rest of their career has then felt quite anticlimactic and there's nowhere for them to go. So I'm quite happy that it's been this gradual ticking away, a gradual ascent, really, and having an audience that has been loyal and stood by.
It is that, I think, listening to that record and then moving on to Infected, it's the melodicism and romanticism and cynicism in equal measures, I think, is how I feel about it.
Yeah, I prefer to use the word scepticism rather than cynicism.
Okay.
But yes, and it's interesting because I've often been labelled as a political songwriter, but it's only a minority of my songs that are political. Probably 80% of my songs are about life and love and loss. I think part of the reason is there's so few political songwriters around compared to, say, if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, where there was far more political songwriters around. And not many people want to tackle certain subjects, and I feel an obligation. I like to write about those things, but I certainly don't not my intention to be perceived as a protest singer or primarily a political singer. That's not what I've wanted at all.
What I wanted to ask you about was infected the movie. I was doing a bit of reading and viewing about that, which was the film that kind of came out. I guess it didn't accompany the record. It kind of was part of the record.
Yeah.
It was filmed in Peru, Bolivia and New York using four directors and cost $350,000, which is the equivalent of $1.1 million today. I mean, the scale of a project like that, even then, it's kind of staggering that you made that happen, and you were allowed to make it happen, and you managed to will something of that scale into existence.
Yeah, it was. And a large part of the credit for making that happen must go to my manager at the time, Steve-O from Some Bizarre, who I mentioned earlier on. And how that came about, because I didn't want to tour, and there was a lot of pressure on me to tour for Soul Mining. I said, I just can't do it. What am I going to do, take Jules Holland and all these other musicians on tour with me? It just wasn't feasible. I thought, I can't do it justice, so I'm not going to tour it. Which I didn't. I never played live to support Soul Mining. So then Infected comes round, and CBS, as Sony were then known, put a huge amount of pressure and said, look, you've got to tour, got to tour. I said, no, I don't want to tour. This Infected was going to be even harder because there was 27 musicians on that, I think, whereas there was only 13 on Soul Mining. I thought, we can't do it. There's orchestras and brass. We said, well, what we will do instead, if we can allow to do a film, no one had ever done anything like this before, we want to do a film for every song on the album. And then I promise, I said, I will fly around the world, go everywhere to promote it, which I did, actually. And then they agreed, to their credit, they paid for it, and we made it. It was very grueling to make that film. And then I travelled Australia, New Zealand, across America, often just by myself. There'd be cinemas rented, and I'd be propped up in the corner somewhere, probably sipping on a vodka and tonic. And the films would be shown, a great reaction, and then I would chat to people and do interviews. And it was a long promotional campaign, but I kept my word. They kept their word, and I kept my word. No one had ever done anything like it before or since, really. Funny enough, I hadn't seen it for many, many years, and a few years ago we got contact about the ICA in London and about screening it again, and I think we had a week of screening. They were all sold out, the screenings. They did very, very well, and we got them remastered off the original tapes. And so I watched it by myself on the big screen at the ICA. We were just setting up the sound and the screen, and I sat and watched it. I hadn't seen it for donkey's years, and I thought, wow, this really stands up. Obviously, I was not younger and fitter and running around with my shirt off, which I wouldn't do these days. I was quite impressed with that because it was a lot of passion and sincerity and working with good people. We had a great time doing it. I found it quite electric, really, and I was pleased.
So by the time 1989 and Mind Bomb comes around, that's like it's what you would define a hit record to kind of be. As an artist that came very much from the kind of left field and very much had very clear visions about what they wanted to do and the control of everything, when the pop star phone starts ringing, how do you think you cope with that, that kind of level of attention and that level of fame and the demands and the temptations of the whole, that world?
It was a strange experience, really, the whole thing, because on the one hand, you know, though there was born out of the post-punk world, and my colleagues and the people I was listening to and hanging out with some of those bands that I mentioned earlier on, and that was very left field and experimental. But before that, as we spoke about earlier on, I was a fan of pop singles, glam rock. You know, I'd love traditional songwriters, whether it's Bob Dylan and Hank Williams, Leonard Cohen, those sort of things. So there was two parts to me. There was the, or more than two parts, I suppose, but there was the traditional songwriter, lyricist element, which I loved and I aspired to. There was the experimental left-field scene that I was a part of and that I enjoyed, and I really enjoyed creating that sort of music coming from it. And there was also that part of me that was the 12-year-old boy prancing around with a tennis racket, pretended to be a pop star. And so,
all going on at the same time.
Yeah, though, they were all going at the same time. And so then, having had that experience, and I didn't care for it much, really. And I found it puffed up the ego too much. And that's the thing that people don't understand. So when that sort of early flush of fame happens, it doesn't just affect the person themselves. The person who starts becoming more famous starts to become a bit egotistical and unreasonable and narcissistic. but it also affects the people around them. So they start acting differently towards you because they get affected by it as well. So the whole thing,
right, okay.
I found a bit unpleasant, and a certain amount of paranoia creeps in. I didn't like it, and I don't like it, and I've seen it happen to myself. It becomes quite destructive, and luckily I think I came out the other side okay. I had to experience some ego deaths, which were good for me. And I've said this before, fame and celebrity is toxic, I think. It's not a natural state, but over experience you get comfortable with it and you figure out, you don't take it too seriously. So it's best not to take the extreme adulation too seriously or the extreme criticism, because however high a person rises in terms of famous celebrity, we know, particularly in a country like Britain, that they're going to be brought crashing down. And I think you've got to prepare yourself for that and not take either state too seriously. So don't get too overinflated as you're going up, to avoid getting too crushed as you were going to come down.
I think you're right. Let's do another record. Oh, this is a record you've said is probably the most heavily played album you've ever owned. Tony Scott's Music for Zen Meditation.
Yes.
How did this record come into your life and why does it occupy a special place in your heart?
Well, I lived in New York for many years with my partner, Johanna. We found this fantastic Korean spa and it was quite hardcore because you would go in there and they would put you in like a steam room, first of all, and then you would go into a sauna. So you'd rotate between the steam room, the sauna, and then they'd have these hot and cold tubs. So ice cold, and you'd be like, shiver, ice cold. And then you would put in a boiling hot one. And it was this old Korean chap called Dr. Lee, and he would come in and wag his finger, oh, you're not doing it rightly. And so you'd be in there for a couple of hours, and then you would go into this darkened room, and they would have it for, so couples, she'd be in one, I'll be another, and there'd be these ropes dangling from the ceiling, and they would have these masseuses that would then walk up and down your back. And I've got quite a high pain threshold, but even I was brought to tears almost at times because it was so intense. But then you would walk out there and you'd feel about 10 years old, you'd feel so light and limber. But anyway, there's all this amazing music going on in the background. I used to love it. And it was all very, very darkly lit in this place. And there was never many people there. It was quite mysterious. And then one day I asked them, I said, what is this music? I said, I absolutely love this music. And they just showed me the cover. And it said, Music for Zen Meditation by Tony Scott. And so, of course, I went and bought a copy. Over the years, I've played it again and again. And I found out about Tony Scott. You know, he was a very famous New York jazz clarinetist. And he was quite an interesting character because he went off on a bit of a tangent. He travelled the world collaborating with different musicians across Asia. And actually, one of the pioneers of, you could say, world music. And certainly even, I don't really like the term New Age, but sort of ambient music or New Agey music. He was very much ahead of his time. And I do find, you know, I travel a lot. And if I'm particularly wound up in stress and need to relax, I may go to my hotel room. I might light a bit of incense, or if I may decide to meditate, but I'll put this on, and it instantaneously puts me in a very calm space. So I'm always talking about this album because it had such a big impact on me.
Side out, hope is down. gallows lies sit on the throne. Something in the shadows communicates by code. The unthinkable is now thinkable. The poison, it's drinkable. So get with the program, get in sync. You better self-centre for wrong think.
Now we have Insolment, first album in 25 years. The first track you released was Cognitive Dissident. Why was that the right song to be the first song that people heard? Great bass on that, by the way. Amazing bass line.
Well, all decisions are made on a musical level. It's the opening track to the album. I thought it was very strong. But interestingly, for the first time, I don't normally take polls, but because this was the first album in 25 years, when we finished the album, I played it to the band, I played it to a bunch of our trusted friends and advisors all come round, and I asked everybody, you know, like, mark off what you think of potential singles, because every song was marked down as a potential single, every single one. But Cognitive actually got more votes, and I voted for that as the first single as well, because I felt it was strong. I loved Barry's guitar work on it. It's quite cinematic, actually. In fact, when Barry first played me that as an idea, and I said, OK, I want to turn that into a song, and I wrote lyrics for it, and we worked out the arrangement, it reminded him, when he wrote it, of like Lalo Schifrin, you know, the famous film composer. So there was an element of that which I liked in it, and it was just, it seemed to represent the band, where we are at this moment in time, quite well. And being the opening track to the album, it seemed a natural opening single.
And the final question, we're going to ask you to pick the song that we play out on. It can be anything you want. It can be a favourite song of yours or something you heard this morning. How should we finish the interview?
I had a throat operation, knocked me for six months. Then there was a period after that, I had quite a few sort of parties around my place, and I was having a good time, enjoying myself. And I had some great soundtracks, and there's one track that I played a lot, and that is Lone Ranger by Betty Davis. That is a particular one that whenever I hear it, I think about all the parties I was having at my studio and office. We had some great times. It sums up the period just before I wrote Insolment and got focused. It's a great track there.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to speak to you.
Shooting popper, and when you're wrong,
Lone Ranger by Betty Davis, the final choice of my guest on the first time today, Matt Johnson from The. It's a good one, isn't it? And that is the end of this run of the first time on Six Music. You can listen back to the whole of the past two seasons on BBC Sound, which include my interviews with Lucy Rose and Fraser T. Smith and Boy George, Bernard Butler, Isabel Campbell and Kareem Bailey-Ray. Just go to BBC Sounds. But until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thank you very much for listening.